What is it about the United States that visitors from abroad notice the most? As a journalist from Germany sees it, where do you start?
It's the huge variety of things that you have to offer, from deserts to the Caribbean, from mountains to crazy cities, from New York to a town in Nebraska.
Coming up, Stefan Wagner shares a few of his supersized impressions about America. He also lets us in on what Americans tend to notice about his fellow Germans when they visit Europe.
Why are you so blunt? Why are you so direct?
In London, Laura Makelam looks to uncover hundreds of years of history that might pop up when the River Thames is at low tide. Laura is a licensed mudlarker.
Every tide reveals new treasures. It's constantly eroding. The mud is constantly revealing new objects.
See what the tide reveals in London and get a German perspective on America. It's just ahead on Travel with Rick Steves. It's the kind of hobby that can leave you a muddy mess and put a big smile on your face as low tide on the River Thames puts you in touch with the lives of Londoners from long ago. Coming up on today's Travel with Rick Steves, Laura Makelam tells us how mudlarking the banks of the Thames can reveal treasures from London's past. If you've ever driven Route 66 and stopped for a bowl of chili at a roadside diner, chances are people at one of the other tables near you were speaking German and making a vacation out of a classic American road trip across the desert Southwest. The unique American landscapes and the many cultures that call it home seem to hold a fascination for many a German tourist. In just a second, we turn the tables on a Munich-based journalist who once interviewed me for a German magazine on how to become a cultural chameleon. Stefan Wagner joins us now to look at what sets Americans apart from their European cousins. Stefan, nice to have you back with us on Travel with Rick Steves.
Great to be here. Thanks, Rick.
You know, I like to say that we can learn about our own culture by leaving it and looking at it from a distance. And in a sense, that's what I'd love to do right now with a lightning round of quick little cultural observations. So this is like a quick association game. I don't know if you've ever done that in Munich, but I'm going to say the topic and you're going to just give me your take as a German, okay? So if we're thinking about America from Germany's point of view, if I say Disneyland, what do you think?
Well, I went there in 2015, and it was a very interesting experience for me because I walked among a plastic redwood forest right a day after having gone through a real redwood forest. It's definitely a place everybody should check out once in his or her life, especially if you have kids, but it's probably not the place you have to go back a lot of times.
Do it once. All right. Big cars.
Big cars. Yes, big cars. We have little cars, but we go a lot faster on the Autobahn. And if there's something you want to travel at the speed of a cruise missile, go to Germany.
So we got the big engines, but you've got fast cars and well-engineered highways. What about the Great American Road Trip?
I did a piece on that, and it's I did a lot of research on it. It's actually one of the big things for Europeans to come to the U.S. for, travel Route 66 or travel anywhere, experience the vastness of this country with their own road movie soundtrack in the background. It's one of the biggest things for Europeans to come to the U.S. for.
You know, when I drive over Germany, which is the size of Montana with one third of our population, I look down from the airplane and I see little towns well contained, close together, and then green spaces in between. And I don't see the vast expanse that you're talking about. So it is interesting that a German would come to the United States because of the distance between the cities.
It's a small world compared to a big world. And it's the big world that we are really fascinated by.
In that case, let's talk Texas.
Texas. Big hats, good burgers, lots of cows.
All right. American beer.
Love it.
Yeah.
It's a very surprising answer, but I think your microbrewery trend is just amazing, and I've been tasting American beer for 30 years. It gets better every year.
And you're coming from Munich, which I think it's like the self-proclaimed beer capital of Germany.
Well, we love to try different things, and I really think you do great stuff there.
And how about American Oktoberfests?
I haven't been to one yet, but I can highly recommend the German one. Bring a lot of thirst and bring a lot of money, too.
You know, we have an Oktoberfest in my town, and they don't let dogs and they don't let children. Can dogs and children go to the Oktoberfest?
Absolutely. They're an integral part of the Oktoberfest.
There you go. That was my feeling. If you went to a party and the theme was to dress up like an American, what would you wear?
Well, I'm old. I'd probably wear a cowboy hat and some chaps.
A cowboy hat? Okay, that'd be fun. You'll come to my party.
Well, we had this writer in the 19th century, Karl May, who described a lot of fantastic stories about Indians and cowboys and the American culture and the pioneer spirit before Westerns. And that strangely formed the German idea of what the American West is like. He's never ever been to. It's still very pervasive, popular book still. Every kid has read these books. I'm not even sure if you can read it in English, if there's any translations, because you have the real thing.
But that's interesting to know that there is a romanticized image of many things in America's past over the Atlantic.
Very much so.
And that's why Buffalo Bill was such a hit when he came to Europe with his Buffalo Bill Wild Cowboy and Indian show, you know.
And there's still people reenacting cowboys and Indians in parks in Germany.
Speaking of romanticism, what about American communities that are German? Like, I live near a town called Leavenworth up in the mountains, and it's a touristy place, and it's a faux German community, and it's kind of a lot of fun for a lot of people.
To be very honest, it's an interesting take because it's sort of a conversation of what Germany used to be like in the 50s or 60s. It's not the current Germany, so even more of a reason to actually go and look at what it's like now, half a century later.
That's a very good point, because when I was a kid, it was all cuckoo clocks. Everybody bought a cuckoo clock. Nobody talks about cuckoo clocks now.
You can still get them, but they do look different. But the cuckoo's still there.
The cuckoo's still there. Stefan Wagner is a journalist based in Munich and helping us see America through German eyes right now on Travel with Rick Steves. His beat includes societal trends, travel, science, and politics in North America for the German audience. You'll find his work in prominent German-language print and online publications. Stefan, if I say the word Las Vegas, what does a German think?
Have to be there. I personally love this place for 2 days, and then I'm super happy to walk off to the desert and just sit there on my own and reflect of what I've seen. But it's a great place. Everybody has to just experience it once in his or her own life because it's crazy. And that's one thing I think Germans love about the U.S. It's the variation. It's the contrasts. It's the huge variety of things that you have to offer, from deserts to the Caribbean, from mountains to crazy cities, from New York to a town in Nebraska. It's everything you could possibly imagine, and it's the full picture.
Rock and roll.
Rock and roll, it's probably the biggest cultural influence that we have experienced in Germany's turned the general mood towards the U.S. in a very positive way. Everybody loved Elvis. Everybody loved rock and roll. It changed behavior. It changed the culture. You can't overestimate it, the influence of American music on Europe.
Fast food.
Sometimes I love it. Most times I hate it.
What do you have for fast food in Germany? I've seen pretzel stores that sell all kinds of pretzels on the freeway off-ramp.
There's pretzels, there's donor stores, there's, of course, the indomitable sausage in all kinds of variations. So there's plenty of stuff, but as you know, it's probably not really the healthiest part.
We have the term gut bomb. Do you know this word, gut bomb?
I haven't heard, but I'll use it from now on.
Gut bomb. How would you say that auf Deutsch? A stomach explosion.
It's stomach filler, Magenfüller.
Okay, you can go home and start that phrase. Movie stars.
Well, I mean, what do you say? It's the biggest cultural influence that you can possibly have on the world is Hollywood, and it's still going strong. Everybody in every country of the world knows about the big movie stars. I think one of my favorites is probably the older stars, Humphrey Bogart, and I hate to say it, even Brad Pitt is not the youngest anymore, but these are the people that we still sort of look up to and admire.
So would you say movie stars, American movie stars are bigger in Germany with the young generation and the movie-going generation than German movie stars?
I would say so, yes. It's a very dominant cultural force that... Everybody knows these people.
Because Americans, we're not aware that we have such a huge market. But if you lived in a smaller culture, Norway, you would draw from a bigger culture's music and movie stars. Germany is a big culture, but it's about a third of ours from a people point of view. Getting back to rock stars, is your rock and roll world mostly Germans or a mix or mostly Americans?
It's a mix. I'd say 80% non-German, 20% German.
But 80% non-German.
It's a growing trend to have more German music, but it's still.
Okay.
If you look back on the 20th century, I mean, it's everything is American: literature, culture, the arts, theater, music, everything.
Donald Trump.
Heard of him? I think in general, there's a mixed take in most other countries. I would say in Germany, probably about 80% would not vote for him. But yeah, we'll see what happens.
Would you say there's a growing, you know, we have the Trump base, which is a legitimate part of our country, obviously. This is 30% of our country or whatever. Is there a equivalent of a Trump base in Germany?
We have a new party that's been around for about 10 years called AfD, the Alternative for Germany, Alternative für Deutschland. And they pretty much follow a Trump agenda, especially when you look at the Ukraine war.
Yeah.
They're very critical of the German and the NATO and the Western support for Ukraine.
What percent of the populace would that be?
Right now they're at 20%, which is
substantial.
It's pretty amazing. And you have to consider, I mean, we're 400 miles away from the Ukraine.
Yeah.
It's like the distance between Chicago and Pittsburgh.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Stefan Wagner. He's visiting us from Munich. He's a journalist and he spent his career writing so German people can better understand America to a certain degree. He's in our studio today sharing the German perspective on the United States of America. Now, you are a self-described lover of Americana. What does that mean to you?
I love the little things about America that make America, America. It's just the stuff, going to a diner and having a free refill cup of coffee. It's something you would never get in Europe. And it's wonderful. I love the friendliness of the people. I have a lot of friends in the U.S. And it's also the small things. Until recently, I think there was a bookstore somewhere in the Southwest where the owner walked around naked and sold books naked. Stuff like that. And the weird tourist attractions like the big ball of twine. All that kind of stuff, the statues of fish or dinosaurs as you travel the highways. It's all part of the American road trip that holds an incredible fascination for Europeans because as you drive by, it's like being in your own road movie.
In just a bit, we'll hear what kinds of historical discoveries mudlarking can unveil from the shores of the River Thames in England. But we'll continue with German journalist Stefan Wagner in just a moment as we flip the topic to hear what he's noticed Americans have to say about Germany when we travel to his home turf. And maybe look at some of what we can learn from each other. Danke schön for coming along. It's Travel with Rick Steves. We've been hearing German impressions of America from journalist Stefan Wagner today on Travel with Rick Steves. So let's continue our conversation with Stefan from a different angle. Let's find out what Stefan's been hearing from Americans as they try to figure out how things work in Germany. Now, you're German and you've been dealing with Americans probably for decades in Munich. What's an annoying kind of stereotype that Americans might have about your culture?
I wouldn't say it's annoying. I think it's baffling to a lot of Americans to deal with the German bluntness and directness. I think it's one of the points that a lot of people get upset, including my family. I'm married to an American, and the in-laws say the same thing. Why are you so blunt? Why are you so direct? And it's the way we're supposedly raised to really say what we think.
No, I've noticed that when I'm in Germany, too. It does take me by surprise a little bit. And why do you think Germans prize that kind of directness? Why be blunt?
If you ask an American how he or she is feeling, the answer is, yeah, I'm fine, all good. But if you ask a German, the answer would really be a very detailed response on medical conditions and the current psychological state of mind of the person you're asking this. I think we're just race to be honest and not hold back. And it's one of the big things that you probably hear all the time. Americans are superficial, which they aren't. But it's...
I don't know about that, we're not, because we have a kind of a smiley face culture. And I had a German friend that flew over here once, and he was astounded at how everything was just smiley face. They even had smiley face art on the shopping paper bags at the grocery store. And it was just like, smile and be a winner. The bank would actually encourage the tellers to always say, have a happy day, you know. And I guess from a German point of view, that doesn't come across as sincere.
Exactly. But the longer you're here, I think the more you enjoy it. That people say you're not sitting in row 3D on the plane, you're sitting in row 3 delightful. And I experienced that on my flight in yesterday, and it just leaves you with a smile. And what's wrong about smiling?
And that's one thing we Americans can capitalize on, take advantage of in our travels. We're more comfortable being informal. It's not rude or particularly polite. It's just how we are. And a German society would be more formal. You would be Mr. Wagner for a little while before you'd be Stefan.
With you for a very short time. But yes, you'd be taken aback if somebody addressed you on a first-name basis.
Mm-hmm.
I think one other thing is that Americans might be struck about Germans is I would call this nation the world's wealthiest whiners. We just love to complain. Everything's horrible. Things are gloomy and doomy, but really they aren't. It's one of the most developed, wealthiest nations with a great welfare state and everything. There's no reason to whine.
But Germans are inclined to complain about things.
Exactly.
When they're together. That's interesting. Now, Stefan, anybody who travels to Europe knows that different countries have a different take on modesty and nudity and so on. And when you go to Germany, you see people sunbathing naked in the parks. You see perfect strangers, men and women, naked together in the spas. On my tours, we would go to Baden-Baden, and my mission was to take Americans into the spa in Baden-Baden, where Germans just, they're not hung up on nudity at all. We've got school teachers in parts of Florida that are losing their job if they show a photograph of Michelangelo's David. Public TV stations actually need to flag my shows to see how many marble breasts and how many canvas penises we're showing on our TV show, because in some markets in the United States, they don't want to show that until after bedtime. How do Germans deal with nudity, and how do Germans look at Americans that have this prudish approach to that?
You mentioned nudity and modesty. I think it's two totally different things. You can be a very modest person who's nude, and you can be a very nude person who's modest or not. But I would say that's the way we were created, and there's no reason to hide it. There has been a massive culture with nudity in Scandinavian and also Central European countries. It's not a big deal. It's just the way things are. You wouldn't cover your face just because you think it's not pretty.
So lunchtime, you got a break in Munich. It's a sunny day. Get on your bicycle. Go to the Englischer Garden.
I work 3 minutes away from it. I go to the garden, but for a beer instead of a nude swim.
A nude
skinny
swim.
Dip.
But you'll see a lot of nude people in the summer in Munich.
You can do it, but the interesting thing is it's only American tourists that go there and look at them. Most people just ride their bikes by and say, okay.
That's the thing.
They're going for a swim. They're sitting in the sun. They don't notice. They don't focus on the...
And Americans will go all across town to ride their bikes through that just to go, whoa, did you see what I saw? This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Stefan Wagner. And Stefan is a journalist in Germany. And he's in our studio today sharing the German perspective on the United States of America. You know, Americans have a view of Germany that I think was shaped by what was the American sector after World War II. Can you tell us about how Germany was divided after World War II? Of course, Germany was just bombed to smithereens, and then the Allied forces got to divide up the country. How was that division made, and how does that division survive to this day?
Well, it's a big division, and I think the most important thing to know is that there were two Germanys. One was the former German Democratic Republic, and the other one was the American sector, the French sector, and the British sector back until 1990. I come from the southern part of Germany, which was the American sector.
Right.
And I can tell you there's been nothing but fantastic memories of the occupation force America. Everybody loved them. It was great to have you, and especially with the years developing in the Soviet sector and the oppression in the Soviet sector, the differences became even more apparent.
Maybe the joy of being in the American sector was heightened by the fact that they weren't in the Soviet sector.
Exactly. They were not allowed to leave their own country. I mean, as you know,
right.
In 1961, the Berlin Wall was set up, or the wall also separating East Germany and Western Germany. It's been a traumatic experience to have our country separated by 28. Just imagine a line going through the U.S. Separating the South from the North or the East from the West. And it's the experience that we've gone through.
What lasting feelings are there, or psychological differences? Has that totally dissolved? Or today, can you psychoanalyze what was Eastern Germany, which is now for 35 years been part of a united Germany?
It's a big debate as we speak, and I'm glad you're touching on this topic, because there is no reunification of the minds yet. It's been 33 years that it's been one country, but there's still a lot of different perceptions on what life in Germany should be like. Obviously, the German government poured trillions and trillions of euros into the eastern part. So the infrastructure standards are way up there, but still a lot of people leave that part of the country and move to the big industrialized zones with more future-proof jobs in Western Germany. The idea is really that there's a lot of dissatisfaction on how things have been developing. There's a lot of feelings of being left behind, being left outside the mainstream. And we do have a big resurgence of right-wing extremism in the eastern part of Germany. They're the second strongest party there.
It's interesting. So with the communist heritage, they're the society that is more likely to embrace right-wing ideologies at this point.
And left-wing. It's just a more extremist outlook on
extremist,
life.
Extremist, I see. Also, you have, so we talked about the east and west, but there's a north and south divide also, which fascinating to me, because the Roman Empire went as far as the Rhine River. Everything beyond that was barbarian, and everything south of that was part of the Roman Empire. And then 500 years ago, there's horrible wars. A third of Germany was killed in the religious wars, and the dividing line was the same line, actually. You got Roman Catholic Germany, and you got Protestant Germany. What is the thought today about if you're a northern German looking at a Bavarian, or if you're a Bavarian looking up at a Prussian?
Very good question. I think the main difference really is the Catholic Protestant thing. Obviously, as a Catholic living in the southern part of Germany, we're very happy to have a lot more vacation days. It's public holidays, so we have like 3 to 4 days off every year. We have religious holidays instead of non-religious holidays like you have in the U.S. So that's one beneficial point. Obviously, the North Germans sort of look down at the very successful South with a little bit of mixed feelings. They think we're bucolic. They think we are probably having too much fun, too Catholic, too conservative. Whereas when you look at Berlin, it has a very mixed reputation, looking at it from the southern states as sort of free and easy, happy-go-lucky, but economically not very successful place for hipsters to drink their latte macchiatos.
Yeah. Journalist Stefan Wagner straddles two cultures between the United States and Germany, being married to an American. He's been stationed in the U.S. as a foreign correspondent for German publications. And lately, he's back in Munich, explaining America to readers of German periodicals and websites. Stefan joined us recently in our Travel with Rick Steves studios near Seattle to share his journalist's perspective on our two countries and to look at some of the curious things that make us a bit different from one another. You know, when I'm thinking about traveling to Germany, I'm just always thinking there's some sites that are overrated that everybody has to see and some sites that are underrated. You know Germany quite well. You know where a lot of Americans are inclined to go. What would you say are the underrated aspects of Germany? Because we all want to go to Munich. We all want to go to Mad King Ludwig's castle. We all want to sail the Rhine River and see the castles. That's sort of a, well, I'll see you in Rotenburg, you know. But what are we missing?
I think you have to do what you're doing already, but you have to come back to look at the sort of second cities. You have to look at the places that are more interesting, where you get a more interesting insight into people's lives. It's like going to Rome and not going to the Colosseum. Of course, you're going to go to the Hofbräuhaus or King Ludwig Castle in southern Germany. But I highly suggest that you just go to smaller towns, check it out, go to where people live and talk to real people.
Now, when we talk to real people, We're also going to see a society that is organized in a way that we can be inspired by. And when I think about Germany, I think of alternatives to persistent social problems that we could learn from. When we think about the opioid crisis, I mean, we lose about 80,000 people a year to opioid overdoses. I think you lose, 2,000 a year. That's quite a striking difference. How do you see the difference in gun violence, in drug abuse, in, stability issues, affordable housing and so on?
I think there is a very different outlook on life. Of course, nobody loves to pay taxes, but I think there's a lot of people who don't mind paying taxes as compared to the U.S. We get stuff from taxes. We get defense, we get roads, we get schools, we get fire brigades, we get police and everything else. So in a way, your taxes are an investment in your own life and not you're giving it away to some anonymous force that spends it at leisure. I think that's a hugely different outlook, and that's the one that shapes people's minds.
So there's a trust in institutions that maybe you have more than we do.
There is trust, but it's quickly fading, unfortunately. Unfortunately, that's my opinion. But this trust is fading, and it's the same in a lot of Western societies, that there is an increase in autocratic ideas, increase in non-democratic ideas, and a move away from the belief that the state, the government, wants your very best.
Stefan, it's so interesting that both of our societies are dealing with the same challenges. We're dealing with climate change. We're dealing with immigrants. What are the big issues today that a traveler might encounter and that we could learn from on how Germany is dealing with these same challenges that we're dealing with?
It's interesting to look at our 2021 elections. There were some surveys on what are the biggest topics that people care about and want to have changed or tackled. It was immigration, obviously, and climate change. I think if you ask that same question over here, there would be more cultural topics like diversity, gender politics, gun violence, abortion. But none of these topics really matter in Germany.
That's interesting. So we would have these, what it's called, culture war issues, right? And these are issues, but they're not in the front of the German voters' mind at this point.
Not at all.
So climate change is a big deal.
Climate change is probably one of the top two topics for any election these days. And if you look at the fact that about 58% of the power generation just last month was by regenerative power, it's probably a big indicator on where we're going. We're the only nation that actually abandoned atomic nuclear power. So lots of things are happening. A lot of people are unhappy with it. But the overruling majority really supports this. And guns are not – nobody even talks about it or abortion.
Well, how many people do you think you lose in your country a year to gun violence?
I'd have to guess a few hundred.
A couple hundred. We lose tens of thousands of people, depending on how you measure it, to guns. I was just reading there's 1 million people in Germany who own a gun. Most of them are for hunting. Out of 83 million people, that would be like 3 million of our society. That's just a tiny fraction, and it's not even an issue for you. The issue for you is how we're going to survive climate change.
And you're experiencing disasters all over Europe. You experience disasters in Germany. You experience them in California. It's hard to keep your eyes and ears closed and not notice it and perceive and think about what is this going to be like in 20 or 50 years.
Do you see a change in Germany? Because in a lot of ways, Germany follows America 5 or 10 years later. Are you concerned that you might be in for what we're dealing with right now down the road?
I think we definitely see the tendency for polarization, the big sort, sort of. It's obvious it's happening, and it's not going in a very pretty direction. So I think it's a very good idea to think about this 5 to 10 year delay.
Germans are so smart. I would think you would be dealing with this now before it becomes a problem that's out of hand. What are people doing to keep society together instead of having society divide? Is there any, after COVID, for example, do you get a sense that people are less together?
I think people are less together. I also think there are initiatives to see that we need to get together more. Like in southern Bavaria, there's this small initiative called Zusammenhocken. It means in restaurants and bars, you have one table designated where you can just share the table, sit down and strike up a conversation. And these are designated tables for sitting together and talking to each other.
This is actually a thing that restaurants are making, one table that's communal, recognizing that Germany has a little bit of a struggle to be together like they were before COVID, now that they're out of COVID.
That's a thing. And it's a good thing because we've all sort of lost the art of talking to each other.
I saw a couple of restaurants in my research work in Nordic Europe, and they had the same thing. A restaurant was generally booked up solid, but they had a big dominant table in the restaurant that they didn't take reservations for. And it was designed for people just to come ad lib and be together. And I didn't realize that there was a political motive on that we need to talk to each other. I was just in Oslo. And there's a bench that is bent upwards in front of the Nobel Peace Prize Center. And this bench, you cannot sit on this bench without coming together in the middle because of this curve in the bench. And the whole initiative was, we've got to get together. We're all in this together. We need to talk. And that's a beautiful thing about travel, isn't it?
It is. And talking about that bench, I mean, it can be uncomfortable to slide together in the middle, but I think it's always beneficial.
Stefan Wagner, thank you so much for joining us, and best wishes with your work as a journalist, helping Americans and Germans better understand each other.
Thank you so much, Rick.
We have a link to Stefan Wagner's interview with me in English for the publication called This is Germany, as well as a prior visit with us on the show. You'll find it in this week's program notes at ricksteves.com/radio. Our next stop is London, as we hear how to encounter the city's past as it emerges bit by bit from the muddy banks of the River Thames. It's Travel with Rick Steves.
Ik ben Ferdy Mengi en ik ben van België. En ik reis met Rick Steves. Now, that was Flemish, and it means I am Ferdy Mengi from Belgium, and I travel with Rick Steves. Ik ben Ferdy Mengi en ik ben van België en ik reis met Rick Steves.
It used to be how some of the poorest Londoners found stuff to sell just to get by. Today, mudlarking is a popular way to explore the history London's buried along the banks of the River Thames. Roman hairpins, medieval buttons, 18th century coins, they're all nestled in the mud, waiting to be found when the tide goes out. Laura Maclam is a licensed mudlarker. She's spent more than 15 years training her eyes to find artifacts along the Thames. Her book, Mudlark, In Search of London's Past Along the River Thames, explains how nearly every item you find can tell a piece of British history. Laura joins us from her home base in London.
Thank you for inviting me, Rick.
I just love the thought of, you know, going to London and realizing you got a whole new dimension just slopping through the muck at low tide on the Thames. Talk a little bit about how the Thames is actually a tidal river. I think a lot of people don't even realize that when they're in London.
It is, yes. The Thames is a tidal river from Teddington out to the estuary. And a lot of people think about the Thames as just that wiggly bit that goes through central London. But actually, it's a river that is a completely different beast at the beginning of the tidal Thames at Teddington. It's very almost countrified and bucolic out to the estuary where it's just wild and windy and windswept. It's just the most beautiful place. And yes, the river goes up and down twice every 24 hours.
Okay, and so much history. There's so much history of England that's been just, in a lot of ways, the Thames has been the lifeblood of that. And people, you know, comb through the rocks and the mud to find bits of that history. Give us just a little background. What is mudlarking historically? And then you even have a mudlarking society today with a popular Facebook page. Tell us just the context of beachcombing on the Thames.
Yes, I mean, London's really only where it is because of the River Thames. And there is 2,000 years or more of history that's been thrown and lost in the river. And so, as I say, it's a tidal Thames, and twice a day, every 24 hours, the river falls low enough for us to get onto the foreshore, which is the riverbed. And you get a chance to go down there and start to search for these objects that have been lost and found. And every tide reveals new treasures. It's constantly eroding. The mud is constantly revealing new objects. And you never, never know what you're going to find. So you could find a prehistoric flint lying next to a Victorian coin, or a medieval buckle lying next to, say, a Roman hairpin. And it's the most fantastic place to go.
You know, it's interesting when you say that the tide replenishes the beachcombing opportunities, because I couldn't figure that out. Years ago, a guide took me beachcombing on the Thames at low tide in London, and I was walking through the little pebbles, and I found these white tubes. They looked like insulation tubes from the 1960s or something like that. And he told me, no, those are Victorian pipe stems. And I realized these are historic. You know, Charles Dickens could have sucked on one of these things. And I realized, why is all of this historic stuff in the rocks today? And if I come back in 2 months, it's going to be there again. And every time I walk down those steps when I'm in London to get down to the beach, I find there's all of these historic tiles and these historic stems of pipes, and that's just the easy stuff to find. But I didn't realize it's actually replenished by the tide. Is that right?
That's right. I mean, some of it's washing in from further out, but a lot of it is actually in the mud. They use domestic refuse and rubbish to build up the foreshore, particularly in central London, because it was a working environment. They needed, in its natural state, a river is a V-shape. And so they needed it to be flat next to the river wall so they could the barges could rest on it at low tide and they could unload the contents. And so they used all this rubbish to build up the foreshore, and it's slowly being eroded because nobody's looking after the foreshore anymore. It used to be mended, and the revetments, the walls that contain all this rubbish, were fixed. And these days it's all falling apart, and the river is actually quite busy. There's quite a lot of river traffic on it. And as they go past, the waves are eating away at the mud.
So this is a new word for me, foreshore. We've got the embankment. And is the foreshore area the flat area at the bottom of the embankment?
The foreshore is effectively the riverbed. It's the muddy bit at the bottom of the river wall.
Okay, now mudlark, that has it's a name that goes back to Dickensian times, right? Mudlarking was something people did a long time ago.
It is. The very first reference I found dates back to the end of the 1700s, and they were talking about these gangs of river workers. Some of them were thieves. They were going on board the ships, and they were throwing objects off, and it was the mudlarks searching around in the mud that were picking up these things.
Okay, so today people in big third world countries, capitals, they mudlark through the garbage dumps to scavenge, and it's a whole industry. And in poverty-stricken England 200 years ago, people would scavenge on the riverbanks for things, and where they find rags and rope and things to sell. Today, there's actually it's a hobby. You're part of a mudlarking society. Tell us a bit about that.
It is. I mean, the Victorian mudlarks were looking for anything they could sell or eat or use just to keep themselves alive. And today we're really lucky. We do it. Modern day mudlarks just do it because for our interest in history. And there is a Mudlark Society. I'm not actually a member of the Mudlark Society, but there are, I think, about 1,500 active permits at the moment. Mm. So it's a hobby that's increasing in popularity. So more and more people are going down there to do it.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're mudlarking right now with Laura Makelin. And Laura's been scanning the River Thames for 15 years, finding artifacts dating back as far as the 11th century. Her book is called Mudlark, In Search of London's Past Along the River Thames. And in the book, she describes the fun she's had beachcombing in London. Laura, in your book, you call the Thames England's longest archaeological landscape. Tell me a little more about how it's an archaeological landscape.
It's an archaeological landscape in as much as you can search the tidal Thames from one end at Teddington right out to the estuary. And, you know, human beings have left their mark all the way along it. It's one of the world's busiest rivers and has been, you know, historically. So there is stuff to find all the way down it. And it varies depending what was going on nearby.
What do you look for, and where are the best places? I would imagine, like in front of the Tower of London, you might find there's a Watergate there. People must have spilled things into the mud when they were loading treasures in and out of the Tower of London.
There is. Actually, the bit of foreshore in front of the Tower of London is a protected area. It's a scheduled monument, so nobody's allowed down there to search. There are several scheduled monuments along the Thames that are as protected as Stonehenge, actually. So you have to be very careful there and not search and not take anything away.
Where's your favorite place to mudlark?
Do you know what? It depends what mood I'm in, to be honest. You do find the richest variety of things in central London, obviously. You're going to find things where there were more people. But then when you go out to Wapping, then you start finding things that are associated with shipbuilding and trade from the 18th century. And then you get out into the estuary, and that's where the Romans had their kilns. So you're finding Roman pottery. It's amazing.
And the wonderful thing is you'd think if you're beachcombing, you want to be first. But because of the blessing of the tides, it's not who's there first. It's always replenished with every tide. So you can go to the same place week after week and still find new treasures.
New things turn up on every tide. And the funny thing is that someone can walk along in front of you and they'll be looking, they've got different eyes. They'll be seeing different things and they'll miss things. So it's really worth, you know, if you see people down there, don't just assume they found everything, because they won't have found everything, I can guarantee.
In fact, you wrote, Mother Nature rarely makes perfect straight lines or circles. And as the eye becomes more practiced, imperfections and patterns start to stand out. So you've actually trained your eyes. And if I was to walk down a stretch of the beach, and if you were to walk down the stretch of the beach, because you know what to look for, you'd find different things than me. Give us a little insight into that.
Yes. I mean, I've been doing it for over 15 years now. And you learn to read the foreshore. You know, you learn to where things are likely to wash up. They wash up against posts and in dips, and coins tend to stick to the surface of the sand. And we at Mudlarks call it getting your eye in. And you learn to spot perfect circles and straight lines, because nature doesn't make perfect circles and straight lines. And that's what really starts to stand out when you get your eye in.
So let's talk nitty gritty here. First of all, is permission required? Can any old tourist go down there and legally do a little beachcombing? What do we need to know in that regard?
Yes, you most definitely do need permission to do it. You need a permit from the Port of London Authority.
I've been breaking the law when I do it.
Well, when did you do it? Because they really tightened up on this in 2016. So if you did it before then, you could probably be all right.
I'm going to do it next time I'm in London, but I don't think I'm going to get permission. What will happen?
Well, you should get permission, because if you're mudlarking without permission, you're breaking the law. So, yes.
That's probably so serious. I think I was joking there, but you don't want to do that.
Well, so. You don't want to do that.
Are there tours? I mean, do they actually have guides that'll take you down to the riverbanks?
There are very few people have got permission to do tours, but there are a couple that I recommend. It's the Thames Explorer Trust and Thames Discovery, and they're both non-profit organizations. Thames Discovery, good. They're recording all the larger archaeological objects along the foreshore, and Thames Explorer is all about education. So it's great. The money you pay goes straight back into the fantastic work they do on the river.
Well, that's beautiful. And I would suppose if you take the tour, you're an honorary guest. You don't need to worry about getting arrested.
You don't have to worry about being arrested. You don't need a permit, because you can use their permit. The only thing is you can't take away the things that you find, but you will have a fantastic guide. They'll tell you how to look and where to look, and tell you what you're finding as well. So it's really worth doing.
Licensed mudlark Lara Makelam is our guest from London on today's Travel with Rick Steves. Lara has been scanning the shores of the River Thames at low tide without a metal detector or digging for years. In the U.S. and Canada, her best-selling book is called Mudlark. And in Britain, it's Mudlarking, Lost and Found on the River Thames. Since we recorded our interview, Lara has also written a field guide to larking, beachcombing, mudlarking, field walking, and more. She shares her finds on Facebook at London Mudlark. I love this passage from your book, Lara. You write, "There, lying next to the eroding barge bed, as if it had just been dropped by a passerby, was a clunky copper coin dated 1797 with the arrogant head of George III looking remarkably composed in the mud." There's so much history you can find. When I was in the beachcombing moment with one of my London guides, he was explaining how you pick up these tiles and it actually tells a story about the Great Fire back in 1666, how London was getting away from one kind of roof that required more timbers because it was a bigger fire risk and timbers needed to be used for the Royal Navy, and they were getting lighter tiles, and all the old heavy tiles were tossed into the river, and centuries later we see them in our sightseeing. Tell a little bit about that. For example, the history you can read into the tiles that you find.
Well, there are loads and loads of roof tiles down there. You get the roof tiles with the round peg holes, and those are the ones that were held on by the wooden pegs. So those tend to predate the Great Fire, because after the Great Fire, they were being held on by nails, and they had more of a rough, square, stabbed hole. you get the tiles that have got animal paw prints across them. And I love those because those are just a moment captured in time, that moment when maybe a cat ran across the tile, followed by a dog in the tile maker's yard. And you can just imagine the scene, can't you?
Oh, that's beautiful.
And what I love about the things that I find, they're just the ordinary things like roof tiles that tell these incredible stories about the past.
We got to remember also, London goes all the way back to ancient Roman times when it was called Londinium. What's your experience with finding artifacts that actually go back to Roman times?
It's surprisingly easy to find Roman objects, actually, depending where you are. There's one spot in particular at the moment, and quite a lot of nice Roman objects are washing out. I found Roman hairpins and game counters and obviously coins. And I've even got when you have a sword and you have the scabbard that the sword goes into, there's always a hard bit on the end called a chape. I've got an ivory chape from the end of a Roman auxiliary soldier's sword,
Well,
which is quite incredible.
That is something that's quite remarkable for an American. I'm a coin collector, and I can buy a Roman coin at an antique shop anywhere in England much cheaper than I can buy what we call an Indian head penny here in the United States. And that Indian head penny is just 120 years old, where this Roman coin is 2,000 years old. There were a lot of little Roman pennies tossed around back then.
There were. The Romans obviously built the very first London Bridge, and it said that there was a shrine partway across and that they were just flicking pennies into the river, maybe as a thanks for a safe return or possibly, you know, sort of to appease the gods. And when they pulled down the old London Bridge, the medieval bridge, there were so many Roman coins that were dredging up. They were dredging them up by the bucketful. So there's a lot of Roman coins. There's a lot of Roman coins in England. I think the Romans were very good at losing small denomination coins. We do find a lot of them.
You could spend a penny 2,000 years ago in Londinium.
Yes.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Laura Maclem, and her book is Mudlark, In Search of London's Past Along the River Thames. We're beachcombing in London. And I love the thought that coins were not just something you would go to the store and buy something with, but they could be used decoratively on chains and pendants. And you write about how you found a lot of coins that were love tokens or decorative as a sort of a second life as a coin that ended up in the Thames. And you also talk at length about how, you know, in your beachcombing or mudlarking, you find that one man's trash is a historian's treasure, and you find all sorts of examples of unhappiness, curses, and prayers, and happiness like wedding rings or sadness, a wedding ring that might have been thrown back into the river in a very sad day. Talk a little bit about the emotions of beachcombing in London.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the Thames runs through one of the busiest cities in the world. And there's something about moving water. I think it takes your troubles away. I mean, I talk to the river as I mudlark. It knows more about me than probably anybody else. And there's something about the fact that it's moving. It's taking your troubles away. And people do go to it to throw things away that they don't want. So sometimes it can feel incredibly intrusive. I've found torn up photographs and love letters, wedding rings, as you said. People think that they're throwing things into the river and they'll never see them again. And what they don't think about are the mudlarks at low tide poking around, finding
them
again.
And they can end up in a museum. You may not be able to see all of these on your quick visit to London or the Thames, but you can go to museums. And I forget the museum, but there was a bunch of drawers I could pull out and see, you know, rack after rack of things that were found mudlarking. Do you recall a museum in London that has a good collection of treasures from the riverbank?
The best museum to go to is the Museum of London. A lot of what they have there is stuff that's been found in the river, simply because the objects that we find in the river are so well preserved. So they're often the best examples.
Are they collected as things dug up on the Thames, or is it just scattered through different artifact displays that you wouldn't know they were found beachcombing?
They often put in the notes for the object, it says where it was found, and it'll say found on the Thames.
Laura, for 15 years, you've been beachcombing the Thames. Let's just finish with, I'm curious, is there a particular find that just resonates with you? What would you have from all the hours you've spent beachcombing that's on a shelf or on a wall in a special place in your home?
Everybody asks me this, and I've found thousands of things over the years, but probably the object that is most precious to me is a Tudor shoe. It's 16th century, and it's a child's shoe. It probably would have fitted my son when he was about five, when I found it and I pulled it out of the mud, it was in absolute perfect condition, as if it had dropped off someone's foot yesterday. And inside, you could see the little toe prints and the little heel mark from where the last owner was wearing it, and the lines across the top. And I think shoes are just so, so personal. And it's really that I love about mudlarking, that reaching back through into history and literally touching the past. And there's nothing like a shoe for that.
England has such a rich and fascinating history, and it's really quite exciting to think that it is remarkably preserved in the mud of the Thames. And if you know where to look and what to look for, you can resurrect that story even as a visitor. Laura, thanks so much for joining us and for sharing your discoveries.
You're welcome, and I hope I see you in London soon.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced by Tim Tatton, Kaz Murrah-Hall, and Donna Bardsley at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington. Affiliate relations are by Sheila Gerzoff. Website uploads are by Andrew Wakeling and Sherry Court. Our theme music is by Jerry Frank. You'll find more about our guests at ricksteves.com/radio. We'll see you next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.
With the Rick Steves Guidebook to England, Scotland, Ireland, or any place in Europe, I'll be right there with you as you put together the trip of a lifetime. They're each lovingly updated and carefully designed so you can travel smartly. Pick up the latest edition at your favorite bookseller or at ricksteves.com and make those travel dreams come true.